Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka, and this show is about conversations plus connections equals community, followed by what's your story. And what a story I've got for you today. I would like to introduce to you my guest, Cassidy McMillan. Welcome to the show, Cassidy.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Marcia. It's great to be here.
Yes, it is. And I just, for our audience to know, you are so accomplished. You're an actress. You're an award-winning film director, producer, writer, and speaker, and a returning guest to the Born to Talk radio show. And, you know, the last time we were together live in the studio was January of 2016. I don't know if you realize it was that long ago that we were together, and I know a lot has happened since then, but I thought we could start our show today for those listeners that weren't following me back in those days. I thought maybe you could just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're from and those kinds of things about you.
Sure. I'm originally from the East Coast, both the Southeast and Northeast, and
okay.
I moved out to Los Angeles to pursue more film work and acting work, also screenwriting, just to have more opportunities out here on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. So you do all of that, don't you? Screenwriting, all of that. Have you written a book?
Yes, I do. I've written screenplays, not
uh-huh.
a book, but I also write for magazines and newspapers. I've written
nice.
For, I originally started writing very young and always was fascinated with film and scripts. And if I watched a movie as a kid and I didn't like the ending, I would sit down and type out a new one, you know, whether on the computer or whatnot. And if I was like, oh, I can change that, you know, and I realized the power of film through that. So, yeah, and then back in high school, I was editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper and also wrote for college, but then also started writing scripts. And also at the same time, I was acting as a kid and then as a teen and then as an adult. And so, like, one script that I wrote for a 2-hour television movie, an actress that I sort of wrote it for in particular, also with a role for myself in the film, but I wrote it for this Emmy-winning and Golden Globe award-winning actress. I probably won't say her name right here in the interview.
I was going to say.
We had a private conversation, so I won't go into that,
sure.
But because the film never got made, but anyway,
oh.
It did get in her hands, and she ended up calling me out of the blue, and I didn't even know it had gotten into her hands, and she called me, and we had a lovely conversation for about half an hour, and which was a surprise, you know, to have a
mm-hmm.
this Golden Globe winning actress call you, and she loved the script and all of that. She, you know, said she would have maybe loved to do it and all of that, and she said, you know, I expect to see your name on the big screen someday and all of that.
How nice.
Yeah, so that kind of gave me the encouragement, like, and to let me know I was on the right path and that the stories I wrote were being well-received, and so I said, yeah, I can make the leap to Los Angeles, having prior done theater acting and plays and musicals and commercials and film work in Florida and in the Southeast. And so, yeah, it gave me the inspiration to make the trek out to Los Angeles.
That's real. How confirming that must have been for you at a young age to, you know, because it's such a difficult career, you know, it's so competitive, and it's not an easy career. You might want to do it. You might be that person listening today that might want to do something like that, but being able to really do it must have, you know, that must have been a great feeling for that person to get in touch with you. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it was interesting too. At that time, we also discussed just the subject of how the industry was male dominated, as far as who gives the green light to film a television movie or a film for the theater, and you know, just who was controlling the money, you know. So it was, you know, because, I mean, here she was Golden Globe Award-winning, Emmy Award-winning, but that wouldn't have been enough to get the financing alone. You know, it would have had to have been greenlit through male executives. And so just interesting, you know, that now, though, through the Me Too movement and all of that, that just women are starting to come into their own and be able to create financing, getting it, and producing blockbusters. This year's top grossing films, many were directed or written by or produced by women. So,
The tide has definitely changed, hasn't it?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting as you're talking about acting. We're gonna be talking about that in the first part of our show. And I know that you've just completed doing a run. You were in the lead role. The name of your character was Brooke Wyeth. It was an LA production of the Tony Award nominated, which is, that's pretty darn good, and Pulitzer Prize finalist drama, Other Desert Cities, written by John Robin. Is it Bias? How does that
Bates.
Person say his last name? Bates. Okay, Bates. I didn't want to get that wrong.
Right.
Okay, well, how exciting. So I thought maybe what we could talk about in the beginning here is, can you tell me a little bit about the play and what drew you to the role and how you came to be in it? I'd love to hear about that.
Sure. I had seen the auditions for Other Desert Cities, and I recalled that it was had been nominated for the Tony on Broadway and all of that, and that it was written by John Robin Bates, B-A-I-T-Z, and he was the creator of the hit ABC TV series Brothers and Sisters. He also was one of...
I didn't know that, but yeah, so you had the same person.
Yeah,
got it.
So, right, and it starred Rachel Griffiths and Sally Field, and and then actually Rachel Griffiths played the part of Brooke Wyeth on Broadway. And John Robin Bates also was one of the writers for the NBC series The West Wing. And anyway, his writing is really stellar and phenomenal. And plus he writes women's roles so fantastically. And so when I saw the auditions, because not a lot of theaters are producing this particular show, which is an amazing show. I was like, okay, where is it at? And I read the whole script then and there, so I really only learned of the auditions like a week before the auditions. And when I read the script from beginning to end, I was just like, I have to play Brooke Wyeth. Completely identified with her, and I was like, I have to do this role. And so I just prepared.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about the character? Who is Brooke Wyeth in this production?
Brooke Wyeth is the daughter of, well, first of all, Brooke Wyeth is an author. She writes novels as well as she's a magazine writer, journalist, and very idealistic and also empathetic, thoughtful character, and a good observer and good writer. But she's haunted by a family tragedy in which her older brother named Henry, whom she idealized, and he was her best friend in school and high school. But her older brother got involved with a sort of a political activist organization that kind of went wrong, and he was implicated in the bombing of an army recruiting station. Unclear whether he actively knew about the bombing or not. He said he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ended up committing suicide.
Oh, boy.
And,
oh, no.
Yeah, and he jumped off a ferry in the Seattle area. And anyway, Brooke's parents are well-known GOP, so Republican, conservative
mm-hmm.
parents. And her dad was an actor in the golden age of Hollywood and acted on set with, like, Ronald Reagan. And
is this based on a true story?
No, it's not.
Okay,
but
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I thought, oh, my goodness. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it kind of mirrors some things. And so then Brooke Wyatt's mom was a screenwriter, and so I guess that's how her mom and dad met. Anyway, so when
mm-hmm.
Ronald, in the story, when Brooke's parents, like I said, were friends with the Reagans, and then when Ronald Reagan became president, President Reagan, in the story, made her father an ambassador. And so anyway,
mm-hmm.
her parents are staunch conservatives, well-known, bull, you know, that hang out with the Reagans and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in Beverly Hills, Bel Air. And so that's sort of the backstory. And so needless to say, when her brother Henry was implicated in this radical bombing, you know, and her parents are these well-known Republican and former Hollywood, you know, celebrities, obviously just created chaos in the family, not to mention in any family, you know, the suicide of
mm-hmm.
a child is, the loss of a child is devastating. So with that, the family retreated from Bel Air to Palm Springs, California, and Brooke went to college on the East Coast, became a magazine writer, novelist, but she never really got over the death of her older brother, Henry. And then she recently had also just been through a divorce after being married for just 3 years. And so all of that just kind of created a whole depression.
Wow.
So she was in and out of hospitals, treatment centers for the past 5 years or so on the East Coast. And so this is her first visit home to her family in the year 2004. It takes place on Christmas Eve 2004. So she's arrived
goodness.
From New York after not being with the family for 6 years. And when she arrives, they think she's just about to publish her next novel, which in the literary field, everyone has sort of been like, is Brooke Wyeth going to publish another novel? Because she's well known. But she announces it's actually not a novel. Her next book that's about to be published in a month or so when she arrives Christmas Eve, she announces that it's not a novel, it's a memoir, and it's a memoir about the family and her brother's suicide. And yeah, and what she feels about the parents and what she feels their shortcomings
mm-hmm.
were in dealing with all that.
Wow. That really does sound very compelling, and I do want to really congratulate you because, Cassidy, you've gotten incredible reviews, and I would really like to share a couple of these reviews with our audience because I feel so honored that you're joining me, but I think that these reviews are just fabulous, so... an LA Times critic wrote of your performance as Brooke Wyeth in Other Desert Cities, and this is quoting, Cassidy McMillan, simply brilliant as a determined author whose steely demeanor sees a C-I-R-C-U-I-T-O-U-S.
Oh, yeah, he wrote steely demeanor sets the circuitous,
oh my goodness. Well, thank you for helping me. I'll have to look that word up. Circuitous plot in motion. Her inner vulnerability is well camouflaged until the play's most crucial moment. That was the Times critic. The Orange County Tribune wrote, Cassie McMillan Brooks starts off tentatively nervous and subdued, as if still contending with the ghost of her depression, as well as dreading her family's reaction to her in memoir. But as the story progresses and we begin to see just how important to her continued existence that this novel is, the candle flame that is Brooks' restrained emotion begins to ignite into a bonfire of determination and self-preservation. Those are wonderful reviews, and congratulations on that. That's outstanding. What I'd like
Thank
to know.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I was just really honored and humbled by their reviews, and
you
appreciate
both
the Los Angeles Times and Orange County Tribune critics coming
out
and then really
tremendous,
capturing
tremendous.
The essence of the play and the work.
So I'm curious to know, how do you prepare emotionally to portray a role that is so complex that Brooke was, and spans a range of emotions from depression to anger to vulnerability? How do you prepare for that?
Well, for me, as an actor, to kind of summarize, I'll just say it is a process, and you know, we only had about a month and a half to prep the show, but within that, you know, I just try to focus on, well, if that was me, what would I be thinking? And then you, for myself, I try to always bring some of myself to a character and portray the role from a place of authenticity. And so I might think maybe of something in my life that was sad or upsetting, and how would that make me feel? Or maybe like Brooke felt her parents betrayed her and betrayed her older brother Henry because she saw them like push him away, and one time in an argument saw her father slap Henry across the face when they were arguing. And, you know, so she felt that the parents also pushed Henry away and blamed them for a good part of the tragedy. So anyway, I try to look at maybe past experiences of how would I feel if someone betrayed me, how have I felt when maybe someone did throughout my life, and look at that, as well as researching different characteristics of depression. And also, like, I think you and I will get into the documentary that I'm also directing on suicide and bullying. I know from my work with families who've lost a child to suicide what their reactions are, as well as I have worked with, spoken with, met with siblings who their sibling committed suicide. And so I kind of was able to factor that in to also give Brooke that authenticity coming from me, to let the writer's words come through me. You know, I'm the tool of for the script to come through for that character. And so, yeah, just kind of preparing that way, as well as a lot of times I listen to music. I pick out different songs that I think I can relate to the character, and listen to them a lot.
That's interesting.
And to just sort of get me in the mood, and always before every performance I'll listen to certain songs, and quietly to get back into character. And then really while I'm in the rehearsal mode too, like they kind of call it method acting, where you kind of put yourself in the position of that character. I don't go too deeply into method, but I do use parts of it to, even where in my daily life, I would just think, oh, I wonder what Brooke would do in this situation, or what she would think of it.
That's interesting.
Kind of apply it to that too. So, yeah.
What about the actual physical demand of doing a 2-hour play night after night? Did the play run 7 days a week?
No, we did three performances every weekend. but
weekend shows, okay.
Yeah, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, but also on Thursdays I would run the show. I would walk through the show myself. I would do the whole two-hour perform. I would do my two-hour performance myself.
Oh, that's great.
Just so it wouldn't get rusty, you know, and mm-hmm. and even when I was out and about, like some of my cast members laughed at one of the stories. For instance, I was in rehearsal when I was trying to, because it was like 49 pages of dialogue that you have to perform every night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get
mm-hmm.
a second take or there in front of the audience.
We do.
You know, you have to
live.
Memorize those 49 pages. And so I might have been pumping gas at the gas station, you know, and getting gas for my car and saying my lines out loud as I'm pumping gas. So I love that. Some people walked by and looked at me. I think they probably thought I was on a cell phone. Maybe, you know, they probably thought, I can't see the mic in her ear. But
Who's she talking to?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
These days everybody's on their cell phone, so definitely most people didn't think it was odd. But but it was funny. I just took every waking opportunity to say the lines over and over and over and be like, no,
mm-hmm.
you know, to myself, like, no, she wouldn't say the line that way. It would be this way, or emphasis on that word, not that one. And so I'm always formulating it right up until opening night, which
I think
at times maybe my director was like, what are you doing during some rehearsals? But especially just with the shortened rehearsal time, like we had
mm-hmm.
to get this 2-hour show up, which is heavy with great dialogue, but heavy with
mm-hmm.
dialogue. Yeah, I was like formulating it and molding it and testing out different things right until opening night when I knew, okay, I'm locking it down.
The
final week and fully lock it down opening night.
You did some research about how to portray this character, right? I assume that you mentioned that you almost have to, don't you? You almost have to feel like you're stepping in. You were that character, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and like
mm-hmm.
you said, first of all, also the physical demands, I meant to also add, just in rehearsal time and then during the production run, it was, you know, I had a very stringent diet that I ate and different things like, you know, for say, maybe a friend said, oh, come on out and, you know, we'll have a beer or a glass of wine or something. And it was like, no,
mm-hmm.
no,
mm-hmm.
thank you, you know, but no. And, you know, just really consistent with like water, hydration, drinks with electrolytes in it, lots
mm-hmm.
of vitamins, supplements, and exercise, plus some meditation and things like that. And so, yeah, and before a show, I never eat heavy at all. I hardly
uh-huh.
eat a lot. I just eat something very light, maybe just vegetables, water, crackers, just something to get me through the show
mm-hmm.
so that I'm not starving midway. But then, and then electrolytes and things like that. And then after a performance, you know, so maybe then at midnight, you know, I would have dinner when I got home.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah,
but,
that's...
there's definitely a routine, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and maybe just some ginger ale always kind of calms me too. So
sure.
things like that, but during the whole rehearsal time and through the run of the show is very regimented. And then as far as research, like I said, yes, you know, I look, you know, studied depression and things from suicide and all that, but plus I also listened to any interview I could find with John Robin Bates, who wrote the script, any interviews
mm-hmm.
he did about the play, interviews
That's
maybe
great.
Of a few of the actors who debuted on Broadway when it received 5 Tony nominations on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
So just to kind of see, though especially just also myself, also being a writer, an actress
mm-hmm.
primarily, but then who also writes, I wanted to see what Mr. Bates's thoughts were on the character and the play to see
mm-hmm.
where he was coming from, and I would try and pull from that. Even at one point, I read some university thesis paper on the play. to see, because John Robin Bates was asked about it or something in some interview. So,
How many characters are actually in this play? How many performers are there?
5 total, including myself. So 5 of us.
Wow. So that's not very many, is it? I'm just thinking about that. So you had to personally memorize over 50 pages of dialogue just for your role,
yes.
Correct?
Just for my role.
Wow, I don't know, how long did that take you to actually memorize that? I mean, that's a lot. That's just weeks and
about
weeks?
About a month, mm-hmm. About 4 weeks.
Wow.
Sure. It's and my character of Brooke has two really long monologues, right? So
mm-hmm.
with a monologue, for any audience member that doesn't know, a monologue is just that character speaking on stage. You're not
mm-hmm.
having dialogue with somebody. You're saying, so in one scene, Brooke has a 2-full-page monologue. So if you had 2 type pages of a book back to the, you know, so there's
that's
that.
That's a lot.
And then another one, the play closes with a 2-page monologue with just Brooke speaking to the audience as if she's in a bookstore reading from her novel or memoir that came out. And
mm-hmm.
she is reading, and again, that's a 2-page monologue.
Wow.
And both are very... both are very emotional, and the second to last one, which comes at the end of Act Two, which, like the Los Angeles Times critic noted in the Tribune, Orange County Tribune critic noted,
mm-hmm.
the second to last monologue that Brooke does is very physically demanding, emotionally demanding. It's very kind of gut-wrenching, and
mm-hmm.
She's kind of letting all of her life of anger and everything, but also vulnerability, showing to her mother and father separately, and it's
quite emotional, I bet.
And
I
yeah,
bet.
and at almost as I begin it, like my body just starts, like my hands just start to shake, and so by the end of it, like my hands are just shaking and. You know, I'm not doing it purposely. It's just the emotion of it and the intensity. It's just was very intense, and so yeah, I'm definitely in.
And I bet you must be exhausted.
Oh, very much.
I mean,
yeah.
It must really take its toll.
It does.
One of the things that you had mentioned to me is that when the I'm curious to know about this is what the audience reaction is to your performance and to the whole program, and the fact that you go and you speak with the audience after each show. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. Yes. After each performance, all of us in the cast, all 5 of us, we go out to the lobby and meet with the audience. I also had some audience members just stay in their seats. They were just so, I guess,
it's gripping.
Emotionally affected, yeah, mm-hmm. by the play that they were just like, we just want to sit here. And then they were like, can we just talk to you about the play? Can we talk to you about your character? I'm like, sure. So we, like, one night I almost had like about an hour after show discussion with these 3 lovely audience members in the theater.
That's nice.
But they really take to the show, and I have actually remarked to friends, family, and fellow cast members about that with this show, of all the plays I've done and whatnot, but with this show, all like almost every audience member wanted to hug me. Like normally audience members will shake my hand or pat me on the back or the arms, say, oh, great job, or that was really moving, or
uh-huh.
this and that. But with this show, not only that, but like they hug me. They're like, can I just hug you? Can I just? And I'm like, sure. I go, do we need to hug it out? They're like, yeah, you know. And because the audience, when they got to the lobby, they were in tears because the last monologue I read in the play that closes the show is very emotional. And I'm crying. And as I'm reading, a thing from my memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would just come up to me and hug me, and they're like, but you're okay, right? And Brooke's okay, right? I'm okay, and Brooke's okay. And it was just really touching, and it was, as an actor, that's the best compliment, because you know that you touched them with your performance, and they
mm-hmm.
felt what you felt, and you had that shared connection, you know. I mean, and it's one thing, like a friend of mine who came out to see it, and he was like, wow, he's like, you know, you've been my friend for years, and like seeing you in this just like blew me away. And he's like,
yeah,
you know. And but he was saying that how he goes, you know, when you watch something on TV or Netflix or in a movie theater, you know, yes, you can have that emotional reaction. And he's like, but to actually be sitting there in the theater watching it, he's
it's very
like,
organic.
Is like beyond
mm-hmm.
TV, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and then, you know, to talk with the actors afterward, like, there you are, you know, and he can talk immediately to you. And that's why, yeah, these audience members, you know, are like, I just want to give you a hug, and, you know, and
that's great.
Tell you how the story affected me. And for me, too, I wanted audiences to also be left with, you know, maybe call that family member or that friend or that person that means a lot to you that maybe you haven't spoken to in a long time. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, to also kind of think about that. And
sure.
So, yeah, so audiences just found it really inspiring, and it was just, I was really
humbled. I bet you were. You know, I'd like to take us, because it's kind of a great segue, because we're talking about suicide. And one of the reasons that you were on my show a couple of years ago was about your documentary. And I thought that we could spend the rest of our show, because you've directed it, you've produced it, you've written your documentary, and the name of your film was called Bullies and Friends. And it's about teen bullying and suicide prevention. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about the documentary? I'd like them to sort of have the background about this film.
Sure. The documentary takes an investigative look at the topic of youth bullying and suicides related to bullying. And it, while we address various issues or incidents of bullying or bullying-related suicides from across the globe,
mm-hmm.
from the UK to Ireland to Canada to the United States, we focus on the story through the specific incident of a teen girl who at the age of 14 committed suicide after being bullied and threatened with death by three girls at her high school. And in her suicide note, she named these three girls.
Mm-hmm.
And the incident led to an investigation that resulted in a precedent-setting court case where for the first time in North America, teenagers were charged with bullying through the charges of criminal harassment and uttering threats. And
mm-hmm.
so we followed the court case, but more importantly, I feel we follow the family. And I do want to specifically state that the family wanted the documentary to be made, and they wanted to be in the documentary. If they did not,
mm-hmm.
then I wouldn't have filmed it. And
mm-hmm.
they wanted the documentary to be made so that other teens wouldn't follow the same path that their daughter did in committing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And in the story, or in what happened, the incidents that happened, the girl's younger brother was the one to find her in her bedroom after she committed suicide. He went in to get her for family dinner, and instead there's his sister deceased, you know, and
mm-hmm.
the parents were in the kitchen prepping dinner. And that's how,
right.
I mean, so many of these incidents happen where, again, I've spoken with families all throughout the United States and Canada and about these incidents, and it's just so awful. It's so awful, obviously, but it's
yes.
just something where the parent thinks it's an average day. They come home from work, you know, they're making dinner, and little did they know that their daughter or son is deceased in
suffering.
The bedroom until later, you know, so.
Right.
It's just.
It's a heavy subject. I remember when we were together talking about this a couple of years ago. Do you feature more than one person in this film? In your Bullies and Friends, were there two incidents in this film, if I remember correctly?
Right. We explore different incidents across the globe. We touch on different stories. We focus mainly on this one, but at the same time, we parallel it with another story of a boy who was bullied, who was going to commit suicide, but his mom found his notebook where he was writing in his notebook he was going to commit suicide, and so she was able to prevent his death in time. And then as it turned out, when the news of this girl's suicide hit, that mom got into contact with the mom of that girl, and they teamed up to work on anti-bullying initiatives for schools.
Mm-hmm.
So the stories kind of, I don't know, dovetailed into another. And that family is in there, and we also speak with educational experts. We have Dr. Michelle Borba in the film. She's an NBC News Today Show contributor and author of like 23 best-selling books on parenting. And so Dr. Borba is in the film, who we really appreciate her time. And then also in the film, we provide bullying solutions through not only experts and the judge who presided over the precedent case. We have an exclusive interview with the judge who wrote and handed down the precedent-setting ruling, a female judge, by the way. And the judge declined all other interviews, like with CNN or whatnot, but agreed to be in the film, and I interviewed her in the judge's chambers at the courthouse, and she was extraordinary and gave really fantastic information for schools to know, for law enforcement to know, for parents to know, for kids to understand about when bullying becomes a criminal act and the repercussions it can have, as well as she shared a story from her childhood when she stepped in to prevent the girl from being bullied. And so we have that. And then also just through the teens themselves that we interview in the film, we also interview one of the teenage girls who was brought to trial, who was named in the suicide note. And she wanted to be in the film to help prevent future tragedies. And just through her work, teens really relate to that.
I think I remember knowing that. And because in some ways, she's a victim now of her own behavior, and she's also was very young at the time as well. I think it's an important perspective. How long did it take you to write and produce this film?
Several years. I mean, if I could write now, I would
project.
Still add more to it. But as it is, we're still raising the final financing through corporate means for release of a film, because people don't realize it can be 5 to 6 figures money-wise to release an independent film, because you don't have a studio writing the check or anything. It's just you as a filmmaker and people who are who also want to join with you in your film and its cause to help prevent suicides, which is that's why I made the film, to prevent future tragedies like these. There's always a place in these incidents where if one thing had changed, if a couple things had changed, if the boy or girl had known that help was available, that they weren't alone, that this is an epidemic, and that bullying, the child who's committing the aggressive behavior is the one who has the insecurity or the jealousy or is sociopathic in some cases. And so the child being bullied, we're trying to get the word out to them that there's no fault of theirs. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. because also a wrong notion with bullying that I hear or read online, people's comments, they say, oh, well, only weak kids get bullied. Well, number one, no one should be bullied or harassed, because what we're talking about
Correct.
Is physical abuse, psychological abuse, emotional abuse. And, for instance, I always use the example that in a workplace, as adults, right, if someone, let's say they work for a tech company and they're in the office and a coworker comes up to them and says, you know what, I really hate you, and after work today in the employee parking lot, I'm going to beat you up or kill you. Well, obviously in the workplace, it'd be like, excuse me, there are harassment regulations against that, and I'm going to go to human resources or employee relations, and or I'm going to call the police because you've made a physical battery threat against me. And there is a charge called making a terroristic threat, where you're terrorizing someone. So that is a charge. But yet, if the aggressor is under 18 at a school or at home on their computer saying to another classmate on the computer, I'm going to beat you up, or I'm going to kill you, or they do it on school property, I'm going to kill you after school, then somehow we as adults at schools across the country and in other countries just classify that as, oh, well, that's just schoolyard bullying. Yet in an adult workplace, it would be cause for even calling law enforcement. So that's something that I'm also working to change, both with schools that I speak at, as well as I work with government leaders on prevention initiatives and creating legislation that addresses this. I mean, this is physical abuse, emotional abuse. Why is it at schools, oh, if the aggressor then maybe actually beats up that other student, then what? Then both, in some schools, both children get suspended or potentially expelled. The child who was the target of being bullied and beaten up certainly didn't cause it. And another wrong notion is that it only happens to quiet kids, or that's so false.
Really?
You know, quarterbacks on football teams get bullied. There was a young man who, you know,
committed suicide.
Well, there's Tyler Clemente, and then, but even in high schools, like there was this one boy, I just can't think of his name, it was in the Northeast, but he committed suicide, and he was a star on the football team, you know, but he committed suicide. And, you know, it can happen to the most popular girl in school, the most popular boy in school. All it takes is an aggressor, you know, who kind of stalks their target. I don't call them victims, I call them targets. And, you know, that's all it takes. So, I mean, anyone can be bullied, harassed, stalked. So it's just a false thought to think, oh, it's just a quiet student or a student that, whatever, maybe is smaller or is inside. That does not matter, and that's actually not part of the equation. The fault lies with the aggressor.
True.
For their own reasons, whether insecurity, jealousy normally, and or they're just a sociopath and they're jealous of that other person. So,
was there a particular reason that you wanted to tell this story? Was there something, what was the inspiration that made you want to get involved in a project like this?
I had seen bullying in school, and I stood up for several of my friends with an aggressor, and then that aggressor turned on me and one time tried to have a physical altercation with me, and all of that went, you know, I just told her, leave my friends alone, stop harassing them, pushing them into lockers, whatever. But so I did have that, and then I kind of just saw it too, whether in college or later even in the workplace, maybe just it would kind of be maybe one female who was jealous of another. So then she makes up lies about the person she's jealous about just to make sure everyone else hates that person. And
yeah.
The clinical term for that is relational aggression, and that happens
wow.
with females. That it's like for the female aggressor, it's much more psychological and then becomes physical as well. But normally with relational aggression, with the aggressor, kind of like what I just said before, that it's not enough for that one girl or woman to hate the other female. They have to make sure that everybody hates her. So they that aggressor just makes up lies and says we're going to shun her from, you know, our clique, whatnot. So I had seen that. And anyway, when I heard this story of this particular suicide and this young girl who loved animals, which I am an animal advocate, and also this young girl maybe had been thinking of becoming an actress. She was in drama class, so again, just myself as an actress, you know, so I just kind of related to her in that sense, and I just was outraged by the fact that this girl who could have contributed so much to society that we are all missing out on her, you know, who knows.
She saw no other way out, and that's what's so emotionally so sad. Like you had mentioned in the adult in the workplace, perhaps they go to their HR department, you know. When you talk about solutions, do you pardon me, do you include in your film parents and teens talking about these conditions in the school?
Yes, we do. And
okay.
we highlight both in the sort of two parallel stories that we tell, the true stories of the girl who committed suicide and the boy who was going to commit suicide. Both moms in the film, as we kind of go back and forth, cut back and forth from one story to another, but both moms relay to the audience what the schools were doing or not doing as all of this was going on. Like the girl who killed herself, she went at least 3 times to the school counselor to report the bullying.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's not like she was just so... But the girl didn't tell her mom fully what was going on. She was just like, oh, this girl's going in my locker. So then the mom got her a new lock for the locker, and then she thought it was okay. But because most children who are bullied, and again, I've spoken to over 25,000 students, teachers across the United
across
States.
Across the country, right? And out of the country, probably.
Yeah, I mean, yes, in Canada and then in the U.S., at U.S. schools, and as well as I've spoken in the media overseas and stuff, even in Dubai, in United Arab Emirates. And but most of the students, the teens who have been bullied or harassed, and most kids at one point or another have been. I was most people have, you know, when I'm at a school and I'm like, how many of you have been bullied or harassed? All the hands go up,
right?
You know, even all the teachers, you know, so.
You know, sometimes they used to say, oh, he's picking on me. That isn't quite the same thing that we're talking about, is it?
No, I mean, like I said, when they're going up and saying, I'm going to kill you after school. I mean, like the young lady in the film who we talk about, she was threatened with death and she believed it because in a town near hers, a girl was drowned to death by other teens. So this wasn't something out of the realm of possibility. And one of the girls who especially was sort of the ringleader in bullying her, who is named in the suicide note, one of the girls was the daughter of a prominent police officer in town. So it's not like she thought, oh, I can go to the police because...
No, she didn't feel safe.
The girl's dad was the police, and the girl said to her, my dad's a cop, and he can do whatever to your family, as was reported to me that she said that. So, yes, so in this, with this girl that we discuss in the film, like I said, that the family wanted her story to be told, they talk about how, yes, in her suicide note, she just thought that that was the only way for everybody to be safe, was if she removed herself from the equation.
Wow.
So
how long
ago
was this,
she was sad.
Like
several years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, and we wanted to follow. We wanted to follow the family story because one of the things too that we come across with these incidents, and that I've heard from parents that I've spoken to who've lost a child to suicide due to bullying, the parents say that their friends don't, in community, maybe don't understand that it's a forever loss. And while that seems common sense, it's not. That communities or friends will feel like, oh, well, your daughter or son committed suicide a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago. Like, so you're okay now, right? You're better.
Right, like move
everything's
on.
All right.
Right.
Yeah. And, yeah, and it's
doesn't
like,
work
no,
like that.
Right, that seat at the table, you know, we all know from the loss of a loved one that it's always a gaping hole. There's no closure. That's such a false narrative. So, yeah, there's always that place at the table that's
empty.
Okay. There's always that space not filled, you know.
And the what if.
Yeah, and we all have moments like that, you know, I mean, like, I lost my mom, but, you know, she passed away, and but yet there's still times for me where I think, oh, this happened, let me call her, you know, and tell her
and
this or that. It's like, oh, you know, and just for that split second, you think that. And, yeah. So we wanted to show in this documentary, we wanted to show what happened now, because actually when we were doing focus group screenings at schools and with educators, showing different extended segments of the film, because all in all, I mean, I shot like 35, 40 hours, you know, and you have to condense it to 2 hours. So schools and whatnot would be like, no, fly out here and just show what you have. I'm like, oh. So even at one point, you know, I'm like, well, I have it down to 4 hours. Okay, great. Show 2 hours one day and 2 hours the next. And
wow.
But anyway, so I had them fill out questionnaires.
I was curious about that.
Yeah, and the students, I mean, their written questionnaires, which I have them, are just really, they're shocking, they're moving, they're compelling. I mean, some of the questions I have in the questionnaire are, you know, have you ever been bullied and what happened, or have you ever bullied someone and why? Have you ever thought of committing suicide? What part of the film did you relate to most and why? And, of course, we share them with the schools, like, so we can say this you know, this student, you need to speak with her or him, you know,
right,
get them help, support, whatnot. But in doing that, in the focus groups, like I said, the kids would all say, number one, they don't want to be called a victim of bullying because they've already been targeted and harassed and stalked, you know. So they're like, I don't want to be further victimized by being called a victim. So, and like I said, they're a target. You would say, oh, well, someone's a target of a crime. Yeah, so that's how I term that. But also students, they all related a lot of the same feelings and thoughts about it. And some students actually said, you know, I guess I am a bully. And I said, well, you've been aggressive. You can change that, though. You know, you don't have to wear a label, and no one should be labeled as anything. You know, just you're committing aggressive behavior, but you can change that. But some kids would say, oh, I didn't know. I just thought, oh, well, I'm just calling them name every day or throwing stuff at them. And, oh, well, that doesn't have, like, they go, I didn't
I think
see them
it's
as
funny.
A real person. Yeah,
right.
And then they realize, well, I now see the hurt it can cause.
Did you find in the research of doing this, speaking about the bully now in this part, did you find that any of these bullies themselves had been bullied either from other children or parents or someone in their life? Was there any correlation between that?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Short answer, yes. Yeah, that is definitely something that we discussed, yeah.
What was the reaction when you said that you gave them questionnaires, which I think is brilliant. Did you get a sense that the awareness level in schools where you went was so dramatically improved that bullying had begun to be controlled somewhat? And we talking as far back as middle school, junior highs, or are we going all the way back to elementary school?
Right. The focus groups that we did from age 10 and up
elementary.
Mm-hmm. As they're slightly moving into middle. I would leave it up to the schools, but if I got a request for an elementary school, I would say, I don't feel comfortable doing it with any student that's under 10. And of course, the schools all got parents' permission and all that.
Permission.
But yeah, so I'm sorry. What was the question? Yeah, ages.
What I was curious to know the bottom age of what you were.
Yeah,
you're talking 10.
Right, and if it helped curb bullying at the schools, and yes, the answer to that too is yes. At one location, in the state of Arizona, they had me come out, and they did a mixture of middle school and high school. So they had me out there for 3 days, and for 2 days I did speaking and showing extended versions of the film with the questionnaires. And anyway, so maybe we had three full showings the one day and two the next, and they bussed in other, students from other schools into this one school's auditorium. So we kind of did everything from there over the course of 2 days. So I don't know how many schools total it was, maybe I'd say 4 or 5 schools total. And anyway, at the one high school, their dean of students, she called the next day and said, the day after I spoke and whatnot, she said that there was a line down the hallway, her words, down the hallway of students lining up to speak to the school counselors about, whether they had been bullied, whether they were committing bullying. And she said it was just lines were down
what
the hallway
impact.
Out the building. Yeah,
no kidding.
It's just,
great reaction. I think it would be really important before all of a sudden our hour is up, because it's approaching that. And that would be, for those that are listening to our show, how can they get in contact with you and your website information? I think that would be really key for people to know that.
My website is CassidyMcMillan.com, and the film's website is BulliesAndFriends.com.
Perfect.
But to reach
me that's
directly, especially at CassidyMcMillan.com, and email and contact
that's
form
great.
And all that is on there.
Because somebody may be listening that may really want, maybe they're very active in their parent group at their school and would really like to be able to bring that information to their school. I would think that anybody that's a parent listening to this would want this information shared, so that when you start seeing your children and expressing signs of depression and things like that, you want to be able to know what would be a great way to talk with them, so they can tell you, I would imagine, what's going on in their lives. I think would be so key.
Right, and two things I recommend to parents. Two key questions that they can ask their son or daughter every day when they come home from school that can really facilitate them knowing what's going on with their child, and also maybe to see if there's any indication of they're being bullied or if they're being aggressive. The two questions being for every parent, guardian to ask their child every day is, one, what was the best thing that happened today and why? And that why part is very important. And the second thing is, what's the worst thing that happened today and at school and why? And from there can open the doors of communication. Because most parents, right, when the children come home, they go, how's your day at school? Good. The door slams to their bedroom, you know, or you know, they say, good, I'm going over to my friend's house, or, you know, you know, or how was school okay? Yep. And, you know, so you're not getting anything with that, sort of a closed question. But this way, by asking those two open-ended questions, it can really let you know
exactly
what's going on.
You know, I'm so glad you had an opportunity to say that, because I actually have a very good friend that I'm sure is listening to this show right now. His name is Russell, and he actually does that with his kids every single day, and I just think that's so brilliant. I want to thank you, Cassidy, for joining me, for being part of this very special show between your successful career and your acting and then this enormously important documentary. And I hope that people that are listening will really check you out. Your last name is spelled M-C-M-I-L-L-A-N. Cassidy is C-A-S-S-I-D-Y. And I hope that people will reach out to you. I hope you get the funding that you need. I hope that I've been able to support you in that. And I look forward to hearing the great things that will happen as your film continues to move forward. But I will say at this point, perhaps, you know, we'll visit it again. Let me know. We don't have to wait 2 years for an update. So I want to just thank you once again for being an excellent guest. And I look forward to knowing more about you and when your next acting gig is. You know, keep me posted, and I'll make sure that I share it with my Facebook friends as well. So until next time, everybody, I just want to say thank you, Cassidy, and to all of you listening. And I look forward to having you join me next week when we're talking all about Meals on Wheels. It's always an interesting Monday for me, so I look forward to that. And thank you once again for joining me today. Bye, Cassidy.
Bye. Thank you.
Uh-huh.